This is Samuel Kimball's 11 October 2002, Cultural Complexes.
Of me, I begin to feel manic. And thank God I discovered Buddhism and Zen. Otherwise, I would act manic at this moment. But I had actually spent a little time thinking about how to talk about cultural complexes in this weekend. And in some ways, it's sort of the whole topic of culture and complexes and all of that feels and has felt second nature to me. It's sort of been implicit. It's been part of just growing up and paying attention and following my interests and so forth and so on. And so it actually took my becoming involved in my union training to actually slow down enough and pay attention enough to what it was that I believed that I began to pay attention to cultural complexes. So I had thought what I'd like to do is had been suggested to me quite a while ago that instead of doing Sam what you normally do, which is to just get up and talk with it, you should really write down your thoughts and just sort of stay close to your text, and that way you would probably say as much as you would normally say by your ramblings, and folks would have a much better chance of getting what it is that you were trying to talk about. And so in the spirit of that, I actually did try to do that. I wrote down, and so on the plane coming up from Oakland, Sarah said, my wife said, let me take a look at what you wrote. And I said, sure. And she read a couple of pages and she said, Sam, it won't do. I said, what do you mean? She said, you just have to just be more personable, you know, and just go do what you do. And suddenly I was in this disoriented state because I thought, well, I have done this preparation and you're suggesting that I do it a different way, and it does sound right, and I think I'll try to do that. And fortunately enough, I had brought enough of my other papers and so forth that I thought I could weave together something that would be a little bit more more free associative, but I think you'll get a feel for the idea better. So I thought the easiest way to introduce cultural complexes would be to take you through some of the high points or some of the nodal points in my own development, especially when I entered analytic training, because that's where the whole concept began to take hold. And and I must say that having started there and now some 10 years later looking at cultural complexes as I hope I can make clear enough to you that you can become a concept, a way of thinking about analytical psychology and culture that would be of some use to you. But from my point of view, it's a theory. It's a way of looking at analytical psychology as analytical psychology relates to cultural issues and factors and so forth that's still under development. So I think of it as having open up a rim of the psyche that needs to be filled in by others, and to the extent that I can do some work on it, it'd be great too. And to that end, my colleague Tom Singer and I have gotten a contract and a commitment to do a book on cultural complexes, but it's a very different approach to a book, and essentially the approach that we have taken has been to send to mostly analysts and authors who have done some thinking about culture and a couple of sample papers, one of mine and one of Tom's, with the idea of cultural complexes spelled out in the papers. And we've asked the participants to use the idea of cultural complex in doing any kind of analysis of their work to see if it's useful to them and help them in any way. And the hope in doing it that way was simply to recognize that we really didn't need more input. It was bigger than either one of us could encompass through our own experience. A couple of weeks ago, both Tom and I did a presentation at the national meeting on and the title of the national meeting was Collective Shadow Processes, and the impulse to destroy and destructiveness, something of that sort. And Tom and I presented together on collective shadow processes. And one of the comments made by one of the commentators, one of the participants in the conference, was that this man from, I think, Boston, he said, "I can see why I took the two of you to make this presentation, because it's just too much for one or two people to try to do." So we'll see where we get to tonight. I hope to keep the steps along the way directly related to my own experience, a little bit bringing in Jung through one of his dreams. I want to touch upon the impact of the cultural complex on Freud and Erikson, and then a couple of other little examples. But the reason I think what has happened as I have internalized and gotten to think about cultural complexes is it's allowed me to reread a lot of the analytic literature and history in ways that open it up in a different sort of way. So it's allowed me to see things differently around the roles of culture and cultural complexes and Freud's work and Jung's work and so forth and so on. It's been that kind of generative process for me. So hopefully you can get a sense of that. So I want to start with a dream which I had on the occasion of the night before my first admissions interview to the San Francisco Jung Institute. And at the time, I had no idea what this dream was all about, and it just sort of stayed with me. And the interview process at the Jung Institute is one which includes the invitation for prospective candidates to share as much as they can about their own personal dynamics and history and so forth and so on. And I shared with them this particular dream, just having had it. So this is the dream. I'm meeting in a mosque with a number of black Muslim men. Suddenly, it is time for my interview with the admissions committee. When I get up to leave the mosque, several men prevent me from leaving until I can demonstrate to them that I know and remember the secret handshake. This handshake will acknowledge my continued connection to them. So I had no conscious relationship with the black Muslim or black Muslim mosques or the Muslim community or anything of that sort, but something had gotten constellated, and it's as if I was making some sort of a passage into another world, and my psyche was noticing that through the process of this particular dream. This is not in some ways such a strange phenomena as I began to look at some other dreams and transitions that folks made through culture. So if you just keep my dreams in mind, and then I'll read to you a dream that Jung had on the occasion of a trip he made to Central Africa. And you can begin to see, what I hope you can begin to see as I share all this, is that there's something is active at the level of the group psyche, I'll spell that out later, that seem to have a stake in what the individual is doing with his or her relationship with the group. So that's the initial thought I began to have. It didn't constitute again until much later than that, later in my training. So, this is what Jung says. During the entire trip, my dream stubbornly followed the tactic of ignoring Africa. They drew exclusively upon scenes from home, and thus seem to say that they consider it is permissible to personify the unconscious processes to the extent the Africa journey not as something real, but as rather as a symptom of something symbolic. So the dream that he had was one in which he was having his hair. He was in a barber's chair, and he was having his hair, his straight hair, curled or kinked. And he freaked out. He woke up in a panic. What Jung felt about that dream is that his European adaptation was being threatened at some level. You know, that essentially his psyche, like my psyche, recognized that his identity as a white European man was being threatened by something about his experience in Africa, represented by kinking his hair. And that is to say, there's a wonderful book by Michael Vannoor Adams. You may know this, The Multicultural Imagination. Michael's interpretation of the dream is that essentially the threat to Jung could be simply said that Jung was too straight, and he needed to be kinked. That is, he needed to have his thoughts curled and made different. And that was something that panicked him. But again, from the point of view of the group psyche, something had been constellated that seemed to recognize that his identity as a white European man and his relationship to that reference group was at risk. And the psyche made the statement about that. You see, so that's the parallel. My dream of the black Muslim man just sort of sat there, and I didn't make a lot of it for quite a while, until there's a stage in analytic training called the control stage, wherein you see intensely a patient analytically, and you present that case. And so I had done my control paper and was up for certification. When I had this particular dream, and so we were talking several years later. In this dream, I had surprised a senior analyst who was looking through the files of another analyst. He seems embarrassed that I know there are files on analysts. I do not see other analysts, but there is a committee meeting of some sort taking place in another room. I have a discussion with the analyst about sharing the file with me, but he is reluctant. Then suddenly, a blonde, all-American-looking man drives up in a large red sports car. I realized that he was the analyst whose file was being reviewed. So, if you put these two dreams again side by side, my dream of the mosque and the white analyst in the red sports car, what you see is that there is something about the all-American attitude represented by the red sports car, a sort of extroverted American attitude, that is being looked at secretly. It's not something that we want to look at openly because it would call the whole project into question. And so, again, it seemed as if my unconscious psyche was recognizing that there was another kind of complex operating within the context of the training program. There was this transition that I was making into training, and my psyche responded by reacting to that, making sure that I remembered my racial connection. In Jung's dream, he was in a position where if he had been conscious of the ideal cultural complex, perhaps he could have worked with the energy that was being constellated for him while being in Africa. He didn't have to reinforce or stay so far from his European, he'd have to solidify his European roots or identity as a way to protect himself from being flooded by the experience of being in Africa. And in the dream of the analyst being looked at, the file is being looked at in the context of the training program, the complex, the all-American complex that seemed to be operating within the context of Jungian Institute or Jungian training could have been looked at much more directly and not something that operates in the background. Because I don't know how it is up in Seattle, but there's a tendency of Jungian-oriented training programs to still identify with its European roots and to see itself as sort of European in orientation and so forth and so on, and not look at the diversity issues and the whole issues of race and ethnicity and all of those that as they have grown up in the context of American life. So all of these sort of dreams were beginning to constellate, and I had, again, no particular idea what all of these meant. I was beginning to see that there was something going in the psyche, and I was talking to my control analyst, and he didn't quite know what was going on. And then I finally had another dream just before I was finally done, and I realized that my psyche was making a stronger statement to me about something that analytical psychology had to offer to, at this time, a social problem, but later on it gets much broader than that. So this is the third dream I'll just share with you. So this is just at the end of my analytic training, and these dreams have just come pretty much on their own, and most of the work that I had been doing in my analysis and my control work had very little to do with these dreams. It's as if these dreams were operating on a whole other level and held but not know what to do with them. So this is the third and final dream of this little series I'll share with you. So I had been called to be a consultant to a large prison whose population was composed of a majority of young black men. I'm meeting with three other black psychologists. One was the first president of the American Association of Black Psychologists, a real man. Another is a psychology professor who taught humanistic and existential psychology at a local university. And a third one was a psychologist who was unknown to me, but whose personality was composed of a combination of my father and the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Apparently, the three of them, as consultants, had been unsuccessful in identifying and working with the factors that produce the large black prison population. something was missing, and I was being called in to be a consultant because apparently my Jungian analytic orientation had something to offer. So I took that dream seriously in terms of wondering what was it that analytical psychology had to offer. I have a fly here who seemed to be interested in this topic. So the question was, what does analytical psychology have to offer something as concrete and in your face as the large prison population of black men under 30? I think there's a statistic, don't know if it's California or the nation, but at one point there was a statistic that indicated that there were more young black men in the prison system, the justice system, criminal justice system, than there were under 30, than there were in college. It's an astounding problem. So if analytical psychology have something to offer that, a perspective on that, that would be a very, very good thing. So I was all of this culminated in the presentation I made, was asked to make at a conference on at the international conference in Florence. My portion of it was analytic training, panacea or poison. And essentially, I made the following points to in that paper. That the Jungian orientation has a bias and is intrapsychic. The intrapsychic bias tends to see culture as out there. And so the significance of culture for individuation is missed. And you probably know that from your own experience, that culture is considered to be out there. Second conclusion I made was there's a tendency among us as Jungians to confuse the collective unconscious with the cultural unconscious. Hence, cultural stereotypes can often pass for archetypes. For example, the threatening black man is seen as a classic shadow figure. The black is regarded as negative or inferior aspect of the patient. Symbolic blackness replaces race as a social and political reality. There's, again, to refer back to Michael Vannoa Adams' book on multicultural imagination, he takes up this point very directly when he says a couple of places that Freudian or traditional classical analytic approaches to the issues of race, ethnicity, and group conflict, and so forth, that grow out of that tend to be reductionistic. That is to say, if a person appears in a dream or is talking about racial issues around aggression or something like that, the emphasis tend to be on the aggression. And the patient is encouraged to deal with his or her attitude toward the aggression. So that's reductionistic. But he also makes the point that Jungians tend to be reductionistic, tend to be archetypally reductionistic. And, for instance, seeing the Native American as primitive or the black American or as a shadow figure or at some level even women as anima figures, you know. In other words, there are actual real people whose lives are not reducible to either developmental processes of aggression and sexuality or archetypal factors, you know, that represent some aspect of the psyche that needs to be integrated. So I think that's a very, very important point that you make, that you can be reductionistic either psychoanalytically or archetypally, depending on which way you use the symbol. The thing is how to keep an analytic attitude that's not reductionistic, so to really allow the reality of these large collective experiences, whether you're talking about ethnicity or race or class or these giant conflicts that we have in the world today, to see them reductionistically in either the archetypal or the traditional analytic way is to miss the whole point. The point is that they have their own life, and the life they have is at a collective level or a group level. So I would recommend Michael's book highly. Recently, one other thing I do that didn't tell Sharon she would have read it, but I have a group, a men's group. I've worked for a long time with men. Am I stepping on my voice? to give you just a little example of how deep the ambivalence is between the psyche being inside and politics being outside. Just recently, I have a men's group that I lead and have for years. We have a recent member to join the group who has a long history in political activism and so forth. And so he came in really fired up around the possible war in Iraq, and he was just beside himself, and he was really angry. And I had just come back from doing this paper at the National, and so one of the members said, "Sam, you must obviously have something to say to this man, you know, because he was really, he had been transformed from someone that we could relate to and have a mutual relationship to one, someone who was pointing fingers, you know, and what are you guys going to do about this and that sort of thing." But what he said, it was very illustrative of this issue of the psyche being inside and the world outside, or processes that are going on that have a lot of passion in them being reduced to personal issues or developmental issues around anger and aggression and not being worked out and so forth and so on. He was really hurt at some point. He said, "You guys don't really understand me. You really think that when I'm being political and reactive to these issues that I'm avoiding myself, that I'm evading something." That he said, "This is who I am. I'm moved by something in my response to the collective. And this is who I am, and you guys are trying to get me to put it all back inside." And I think that was the tension in the group. Did it belong inside? But he actually, I think, missed a kind of a point that later on we can come back to, is that it was not so much that we're trying to get him to put it all back inside. It was very clear that he had been caught in a cultural complex. That is to say, he had become possessed by an attitude about the war. And part of being possessed by a cultural complex is very similar to being possessed by any other kind of a complex. You lose your individuality, and in the process, the other tends to disappear also. And so what we were trying to get him to see is that his behavior at that most personal and individual level was a personification of what happens on the larger collective level. That is to say, once you're caught up in a complex, mutuality disappears and interaction becomes difficult. Mutuality becomes something that's hard to maintain a connection with, and suddenly the world is split between you're for me or against me kind of thing, or some sort of us-them kind of an orientation. It was very, very difficult for him to hold the mutuality, and actually the angrier he became, the harder it was for the group members to hold on to wanting mutuality in relationship to him. They will stay away from me, leave me alone, you're pushing me, you're being too aggressive. You know, So both sides were right in an odd way, because you could see that his aggression was out of control, in a sense that the way that he was trying to talk about an issue that was very important to him made him so insensitive to the other that he was actually violating them. On the other hand, it's not quite true to the point that the aggression that he was expressing belonged inside of him. I mean, it truly was a response to a complex that was activated at the level of the group. And that's what we were trying to talk with him about. That if I were just to leave aside for a moment the content of what he was saying, then it wouldn't matter whether he was for the war or against the war. If he had that kind of a passion, he would look the same way and feel the same way, and I would feel just as violated and invalidated by how he's coming on to me. So when we're caught in the complex at the personal or the cultural level, mutuality disappears and so forth and so on. And so later tomorrow, if we have some time I intend to work more with cultural complex, and we'll have a chance to see how we can activate each other, because I think once you begin to talk about some of these issues, you'll see that suddenly the world becomes very difficult to maintain in the sense of a kind of a mutuality. You're all following this? Okay. So the issue of invisibility becomes an essential piece of how we know that a complex is being activated. And so from the point of the dreams to the training, my work led me to a collaboration with Tom Singer, and he put together the book, the Vision Thing, and in that book, the article that I contributed was Culture Complex is the Myth of Invisibility. And at that point, what I had begun to think about was that essentially the basic thing about culture complexes are that they create invisibilities. And that is to say that whenever groups or individuals are caught up in a culture complex, suddenly there's an inability to see the other, but also to stay connected with anything that was human inside of the person. There's the example I use, this one is from the Ralph Ellison, The Invisible Man, is one in which, if I can find that, you may know just this little piece of it, but I find it a very good example of what the man in the group had gotten caught up in, and what Ralph Ellison in his book The Invisible Man was trying to talk about, and which I translate to be a key component of cultural complexes. And again, I'm just these are all just developmental moves. And so this was at a specific time in my thinking about cultural complexes. I still had not fleshed out scaffolding for a cultural complex or where it fit into Jung's psychology. I was just sort of following the dreams and my own sort of intuitive meanderings. And then Tom Singer was following his interest in analytic psychology and politics, and it was sort of in the blind about what it was that we were trying to talk about around cultural complexes, except we knew that we were trying to talk about something to do with a energetic or field dynamic that operates at the group level that structures an individual's relationship to the group. And that I was very clear that the group has some stake in the individual's relationship to it. And that, so that was my initial sort of thinking about culture. That something is happening, so that means that groups have a kind of autonomy and a direction, a kind of a structure, and to the extent are capable of and have the potential for some sort of development, although we rather think about groups developing, which is itself a problem. So this is just a little example from Ralph Ellison, and you can see how he's describing it as an invisibility, but it's a complex. It's really a complex that he didn't have the language for and was not thinking psychologically about it, but there's a lot of psychology in just the example itself. One night, the narrator recalls, he bumped into a blond man who proceeded to insult him. I sprang at him, seized his coat lapels, and demanded that he apologize. He was a tall, blond man, and as my face came close to his, he looked insolently out of his blue eyes and cursed me. I pulled his chin down sharp upon the crown of my head, butting him. I felt his flesh tear and the blood gush out, and I yelled, "Apologize, apologize." I kicked him repeatedly, and in my outrage, I got out my knife and prepared to slit his throat right there beneath the lamp pole. When it occurred to me that the man had not seen me actually, that he, as far as he knew, was in the midst of a walking nightmare, I stopped the blade slicing the air and I pushed him back. So he recognized that he was responding to someone for whom he was a ghost. He didn't exist. So it was one of those moments of enlightenment or awareness about how the complex makes one invisible. And you can react out of that, but to whom are you reacting? For what? So at that point, I was thinking that complexes have something to do with the creation of invisibility when they are activated. But certainly, my dream about the mosque, Jung's dream about his anxiety about having his hair kinked and sent to Africa, was not just all about invisibility. The group stake in the individual has to be more than defensive. So that began to be kind of a question. There has to be something else going on in addition to just pathology and self-protectiveness and keeping an individual sort of locked into his or her own reference group and so forth. That's a very important component. I still believe that one of the functions of a cultural complex is to help us to experience the processes, to activate the processes by which we experience a connection to a group. And that the experience of the connection to the group has the value keeping the survival value of the group primary. And it has the value to the individual of keeping the individual grounded in a reference group. So it doesn't, even though my examples have been about race, it need not be about race. Any group, racial or ethnic or gender or any group, social group, serves the same function. And that if you begin to think about cultural complexes from the point of view of the group psyche making a claim on the individual, then it shifts how you begin to think about analytic work, and it begins to shift therapy work. It begins to it allows for the possibility that outer and inner need not be separated, because the cultural complex is not doing that. The cultural complex is not making that kind of separation. The cultural complex is pulling together the individual dynamics with cultural processes, but it has to do with the survival of the group and the survival of the individual. So those are, so I'm still about 5 years from where I am today at the point of view of the issue of invisibility. But I had begun to think about the positive potential that is served by the cultural complex. So then I realized that I remember that Peter Gay, in his biography of Freud, had made a very interesting quoted Freud. I made a very interesting quote of Freud, and I'm just going to read to you Freud's quote, because I had this idea that psychoanalysis was essentially produced as a compensation by Freud for his having broken from his culture. That is to say that anytime you do any kind of individuation work, there is an old article, a Conscious Adaptation and Individuation, that Jung wrote. Essentially, what he says in that article is that if you the process of individuation, which makes you separate and distinct from the group, comes at a price to you, but you owe something to the collective if you do that. You have to pay back. You can't just go off on your own way. That's not what individuation is. So actually, to say it that way is another way to talk about how the group has a claim, even in individuation, on the final product of your individuation. In other words, what is it for, and what are you offering back to us for that? And if you think about, this is a little bit of an aside, but you think about the whole archetype of initiation, essentially, the two steps of that archetype is about helping the member of the group to separate from the more, let's say, the more basic animal embedded unconscious way that the individual is in the group, that is, to initiate out of that and develop some sort of a spiritual attitude or some sort of attitude about the collective that allows you to be enough separate from the group so that you can do the second part of the initiation, which is to be reincorporated back into the group. So even in the archetype of initiation, it has in it a claim that the group is making on the individual. It's very deep. That connection is not ever broken, you know. Freud, as we know from various sources, but specifically from the biographer Peter Gay, grew up in Austria feeling alienated from his Jewish roots, the religion of his father, and simultaneously hating anti-Semitism. He was doubly alienated. He reported asking the question in a letter to Otto Pfister, a devout Christian, why was psychoanalysis not discovered by the devout? Why did it have to await to be discovered by a completely godless Jew? That was his question. Why? My answer to Freud's question is that, for starters, it took a person who felt completely alienated from his culture roots, that is to say, one who did not work out a relationship to his culture complex. The discovery of the unconscious compensated for and became the container for his missing kinship libido. So the unconscious came back in as the missing collective, became his kinship libido. To discover something as vast as the unconscious through loss of kinship libido, paradoxically, shows how much libido is invested in the culture or the group. You see what I mean? That sort of thing. If you're going to make a break from the group without a grounding in the group, you're grounded. There's nothing. So I'm suggesting that the culture complex is making a claim on all of us. Whatever group we are a member of, the complex is making a claim on us to look at what we're doing in relationship to the group. And I think if we begin to pay attention to dreams and fantasies and so forth, you'll see how much the group is referenced in dreams and fantasies and so forth. Similarly, Erikson, whose mother was Jewish and whose father was Gentile, spoke of acquired alienation from my whole childhood setting, Jewish and German. Later he was to speak of identification as a Christian. Quote, I am not only willing but determined to live on the shadowy interface. But knowing this, it seems all the more necessary to live in it as one studies it, if for no other purpose than that of helping us overcome the potential fatal human need for what I have called pseudo-speciation, that is, the unthinking equation of one's own kind with mankind itself, and the bolstering of one's identity by the categorical exclusion and rejection of otherness. Pseudo-speciation is a way of talking about how the non-positive connection to the cultural complex comes back as a kind of a ethnocentric kind of identification that makes one's group special at the expense of the other. Again, what Erikson is pointing out is that, again, he doesn't have the term cultural complex, but what he's trying to talk about is he sees something happening at the level of the group in which the group seem to be creating some sense of making itself special at the expense or at the exclusion of other groups. So he's really formulating in that response a kind of an idea of a cultural dimension of the psyche operating between groups or within groups. So you can see with Freud, you can see with Erikson, you can see with Jung, or you can see in my dream, hopefully, that there's something moving at the level of the group that I'm calling a cultural complex, and we'll again talk more specifically about what that is. So the big thing was, well, recently, where does this idea, where does this concept fit into the Jungian opus, you know? Jung was certainly conscious of the culture and the collective, but he never actually explicated or talked about anything like a cultural complex. There is an old diagram that he made, and this is where if I had a flip chart, I would show you, but essentially it was sort of like a little bit of a mountain in which at the bottom of that diagram is is sort of the primal source of all human life, you know, and then you go up the ladder and there's the animal ancestors and then our human ancestors and then the tribal and the nation and the, you know, the family and nation and then the top is just the individual, and that's sort of it's a way to picture that there are dimensions of the psyche other than the archetypal and the individual. There's a lot in the middle there. But he actually didn't do much with that. He just sort of presented it in this sort of a static photograph almost of a psyche. And later on, a few years ago, a man named James Hirsch had also talked about something like an ethnic unconscious in which he represented that same diagram. But it was as if there's only the individual psyche and the archetypal psyche. So things that were going on between the individual psyche and the archetypal psyche got collapsed. And that's how you could get archetypal reductionism. That's how you could confuse archetypal reality with cultural realities, that sort of thing. In fact, later on, Joseph Henderson, who introduced the term cultural unconscious, made the statement that much of what Jung described as archetypal was really cultural, because he didn't have had not worked out that understanding of the cultural dimension of the psyche. So, where does the cultural complex fit within this opus? And there are a couple of things that have been pretty clear to me, is that Joe Henderson, in positing the cultural unconscious, made a huge contribution just by saying there was something between the personal and the archetypal that had a life and existence of its own. I don't know if you familiar you are with that paper. Joe actually wrote a paper on the cultural unconscious, but it's interesting that the kinds of examples he used to talk about the cultural unconscious and define it. One is that a dream he shared in which a Medici castle appears on the East Coast. And he took that to Jung, and they didn't quite know quite what to do with that dream. It was a little tiny dream. But they did make some interpretations of that image as having something to do with Joe's individuation process. They needed to integrate that image. And that, so I'm just using that as an example to say that essentially Joe introduced the cultural unconscious. I'll talk more about what that is. But those who picked up that concept of the cultural unconscious would use images that appear in dreams that had references to culture, like, once I had a dream about meeting a Buddha in a forest, this is before I was into Buddhism, and typically that would be interpreted as perhaps meeting something of the Eastern attitude in my own psyche, and that could be used as part of looking at where I am developmentally or psychologically in terms of perhaps needing to integrate that kind of energy. So that kind of approach to cultural symbols or imagery tend to reduce these images or imagery back to individual development. You see what I mean? Individual psychological development. And in the process of doing that, the cultural dimension is lost again. So what it turned out to mean was that the cultural unconscious was one more storehouse that produced symbols related to personal individuation. Great. And that's wonderful. That's great. I mean, that's useful. It's just, again, at the level of cultural understanding, this group-level dimension, it collapses it. It gives it away. It devitalizes it. And we don't develop a consciousness of what the group is doing with the psychological facts of the individual, or what the individual doing with the group level of the psyche that's operating within him or herself. You see what I mean? So essentially, the potential in the term cultural unconscious is that it defines and makes available to us a way to think about the cultural level of the psyche in the individual, and analytically and psychologically in the culture. So it has enormous potential. But Joe did not have the concept of a culture complex. That is to say, that's all well and good to say what I just said about the potential of it, but what's the dynamism that makes that work and that makes that possible? That would become the question. And that dynamism once again became the culture complexes. It became my answer to that question. How are we doing on time? Okay. This is an example of, for me and for a lot of Jungians, that Jung was very much aware of the cultural level of the psyche, but he didn't have the terms for it. And one of the things I did at the National was trace, and maybe if you're here tomorrow we can do some of that. There was a trace the rise of National Socialism, and as it got manifested in Nazism, and beyond Nazism to we have now two or three generations of both victims and perpetrators of the Holocaust. And so it's really possible. The reason that the victims and perpetrators of the Holocaust is an important subgroup, as well as Jung's reflection, is that we have a way to trace almost 100 years of the operation of a cultural complex, because probably of all the traumatized, massacred group on Earth, the victims and the perpetrators of the Holocaust are the most written about analytically and psychologically in all of the literature. So we have all these cases that now we can use to look at how the cultural complex has been operating for 100 years. This is one of those ways of rethinking. Once you have a concept, you can begin to relook at some things. And it may be some of interest to do a little of that tomorrow, as well as do some sort of active work with that issue. But Jung was very much aware of the power of the culture to impact how we experience our work. But again, if you just any of his writing, you'll see that he didn't have a way to think about the group level, how the group level impacted that work. And this is one of my favorite little quotes, but it would be just a transition to talking about this issue of engagement with the group and the collective and that sort of thing, which a lot of us as therapists and analysts often feel uncomfortable with. We feel like we're making space for people to talk about their political attitudes or their political feelings. We are not doing analytic work. But I have lots of cases and experiences of folks post 9/11. One thing I did after 9/11 is I began to document and just take notes of people who were dreaming about issues and things that came up in their responses to 9/11. And a lot of my patients wanted to talk about some of their experiences. And then this year, we have a year later, and folks have very different kinds of feelings about 9/11. But what you can see is if you just, first of all, there's the individual's relationship to those experiences. But then if you take into account what the psyche is doing at the group level with the 9/11 experience, that is, if you take the point of view of the cultural complex, it's a very interesting, different kind of picture you get of what's living in us at this group level, which is what I was interested in looking at from the point of view of the concept of culture complex. So this is from volume 10, Jung's work, and it's just a powerful little sets of comments about engaging with the collective without having a concept of how you work with that engagement. I mean, he's saying you have to engage, but then how do you make sense of that engagement? You know, what do you do with it? Okay. Quote, "We're living in a time of great disruptions. Political passions are aflame. Internal upheavals have brought nations to the brink of chaos, and the very foundation of our Weltanschauung are shattered. This critical state of things has such a tremendous influence on the psychic life of the individual that the doctor must follow its effects with more than usual attention. The storms of events does not sweep down upon him only from the great world outside. He feels the violence of his impact even in the quiet of his consulting room and in the privacy of his medical consultation. As he has a responsibility toward his patients, he cannot afford to withdraw to the peaceful island of undisturbed scientific work, but must constantly descend into the arena of world events in order to join in the battle of conflicting passions and opinions. Were he to remain aloof from the tumult, the calamity of his time would reach him only from afar, and his patient's suffering would find neither ear nor understanding. He would be at a loss to know how to talk to him and to help him out of his isolation. For this reason, the psychologist cannot avoid coming to grips with contemporary history, even if his very soul shrinks from the political uproar, the lying propaganda, and the jarring speeches of the demagogues." So, it's a challenge to be involved in looking at how you feel about the war, as my client was saying in the group, you know? I'm talking to you about something that's very important to me. Or how you feel about the great collective issues of our time, whether it's racism or discrimination or poverty or whatever it is that you're engaged in. The challenge that he's putting before us is that you can't stay isolated from that. So you need some, as practitioners, clinicians, we need some way to take all of that in and begin to work with it. So this, what he's describing is what's active at the cultural level of the cultural unconscious all the time. This is what we live in. And he's also asking in a strange sort of way, how is it possible for you to do your clinical work and not be impacted by this? What are you doing? How do you do that? And I think the answer to that partially is that how we do that is that we're not sure how to do otherwise. Because again, we get back to the bias of internal and external, and that the culture is outside, and psyche is inside, and so forth. And again, the culture complex idea suggests that the psyche is a field phenomenon that we participate in. It's both inside and outside. It's constellating both individual relationship to individual dynamics, as well as the group relationship to individual dynamics. So let me just stop right now and see where you are with questions. Do we have time for... Okay, that's fine. And it's very helpful if you, again, the cultural unconscious as conceptualized as that period, that area between the personal and the archetypal unconscious, but so that's the location part. But he also defines it as an area of historical memory, which is a very important piece of the cultural idea of the cultural unconscious, because it allows us to, when we begin to look at cultural complexes intergenerationally, essentially what we are doing is looking at how the cultural unconscious is structured by cultural complexes in such a way that the major issues or events that are part of the group psyche is kept alive from generation to generation until they are worked with at the collective and the individual level. That's really a very, very powerful point. And tomorrow I'll give you a couple of examples of that process. Once you get that idea, it's possible to look at many generations of group and collective and individual issues from the point of view of how the cultural complex is structuring issues around identity and belonging and wounds and threats and so forth and so on. I mean, just a quick, simple example is the issue of reparation that's active in the certain portion of the black community. Or you can think about the issue of affirmative action that way too. You can look at a lot of the kinds of issues that emerge in clinical situations in the lives of Native Americans or Japanese Americans or white Americans. And for instance, she knew I was black when she came to see me, but she didn't know that she had a feeling about what she ended up saying to me, which was that she realized that she knew that her great-grandparents were slave owners. And she began to cry. And she said, my mother never talked about that, and it came through in some way that we talked to each other. But the issue was very much alive in her. In other words, from the point of view of a cultural complex, what had gotten structured and carried along is the need of her family line to come to grips with their relationship to that issue that was being manifested in her. So the area of historical memory that provides continuity at the level of the group is a very important piece of the cultural unconscious. So you have the location piece and you have the historical memory piece, those two things together. So, and then the third piece that links up is the Jung's idea of complexes. So, and complexes, cultural complexes and individual complexes are very different. But they do share the issues of autonomy, affectivity, repetitiveness, that kind of energetic structuring dynamics. And it's just that the idea of the cultural complex makes the point that it's happening at the level of the group as well as the level of the individual. And as it's operating at the level of the group, it's operating to connect individual and group. So you have the idea of the cultural unconscious, the idea of the complexes, the idea of the complex that fills in the gap between the personal unconscious and the archetypal unconscious in a way that allows us to think about how the group level is structured. That's where we begin to look at how it's structured and moving. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I would say that there's probably some sort of way that all of those reference groups are being utilized by the psyche at different times and different developmental times of the person's life to help work with the issue of connectedness and disconnectedness, because it's the complex actually help us to look at how we're alienated as well as how we're connected to groups. And oftentimes reference groups, being gay as a reference group, oftentimes reference groups that are acquired in the process of developing our lives stand in some sort of relationship with a more basic group, whether it's racial or ethnic, that has attitudes about our new development, you know. So that would be kind of the place where the complex would be activated, because the movement toward a particular reference group may strain or place one in conflict with something that's more basically contributed in a more basic way to our definition of ourselves. When you think about how we take in culture, I mean, it's a long time before we become aware of the waters that we're swimming in. So by that time, the more basic fundamental structures of how we think about culture, the attitudes we adopt toward cultures and all of that have become part of who we are. And so much of individuation from a Jung point of view is becoming psychologically individual, but adding the idea of the culture complex is psychologically individual vis-a-vis one's reference group or groups. So if you think about this little pyramid again, that there's the individual and there's the family and then there's the tribe, and so there's all these layers that's configured in one's identity. So the complex would be working all those numbers. Yeah.
So some of those reference groups are organized with respect to very low, not to say European American law, American American, and so some of them have a hierarchy of that, but others don't have a hierarchy of that.
Right. Yeah, if I were looking, doing kind of a cultural analysis or looking at it from the point of view of cultural complexes, I would be paying attention to what your psyche is doing with the fact of those differences, the way you just described them, and to see how it's configurating them as issues or personal complexes for you. And that would give you some sense of where the leading edge of the complex is.
Your work on cultural complexes, then, is that in the hope for the spirit that people will begin to work consciously with cultural complexes, and that will somehow enable us not to just let the culture autonomously evolve in some way that, when we say the word consciously, then the complex, it would seem to indicate that there's some, or does it indicate that there's some desire that culture moves or change a certain way? Or what would that mean to work consciously with the cultural complex?
At the group level, it would mean becoming aware that there is a field in which we are swimming in that configurate our experiences of ourselves and our experiences of other groups that tend to lead toward polarization and projection and all of that sort of thing. When seen negatively, but positively seem to move towards some sense of belonging and connectedness. So it would be to get a feel for the forces that are shaping the context of our lives. And what we're talking about at dinner, if you can imagine what a simple awareness at the political level of a politician having some understanding of projection and shadow, the revolutionary impact that would have, just to realize they have one and they like to be doing something with it, and that the group has one, our group has one, is likely to be doing something with it too, and just to sort of have that kind of awareness is itself a consciousness-making process. So we think we rarely think about groups as having the capacity to evolve, except if we take a political attitude or a sociological attitude or economic attitude, and then we stay at a non-psychological level in thinking about those forces that are configurating us. So the concept of culture complex is an attempt to bring psychology into it, especially analytical psychology, because we do have some sense of a psyche that functions autonomously at the archetypal level and the personal level. And the only thing the culture complex idea says is that, yes, and at the group level. And let's see if we can begin to chart it and open it up and see what makes it. So we have language for what it is that we are doing, a different kind of language.
I know that you often use more intentional words, and I do that too. Last week was from senior managers and middle managers trying to help them talk to each other. And so it wasn't really talking about the fact that I wonder how you take these ideas when you're working on the organization.
Well, I think most of the work I do in organizations are with mental health systems and hospitals kinds of systems. And so the basic orientation that I find as kind of a starting point is, this is mostly experiential, but not always initially, but is to get the members to have the experience of the power of the group to affect how they think, act, and use each other. Just that. If you can begin to experience just what happens. If we were to make a big circle right now, right, and sit with each other and face each other and just begin talking, the group properties in this room will begin to structure how we talk to each other, how we use each other. Then I guarantee you in a half an hour or so, the anxiety in the room will go up to the top of the roof. Okay, so the question is, why is that? Well, there's a feel being activated just by being together. It's being structured here now, where you're sitting here and I'm doing this sort of thing. To step outside of the structure is to begin to feel the power of the group. So the first step is to feel and experience the power of the group and to begin to develop some language for the forces that are activated. And that traditionally, the language that's been used has been a kind of a beyond kind of language, which is much more about a certain kind of structure within groups, authority structure. And if that's your frame, then everything becomes power and conflict and so forth and so on, and you can get a lot of work done with that. But what Jung and analytical psychology can offer is the image part of what's happening in the group. What are the images, what are the complexes that are being activated that's not just about power, not just about control, but are about things like fusion, about things like trying to create some sort of a dream that allows us to move beyond where we are, you know, those kinds of forces. But that's all built upon, again, having the experience of the power of the group. You really have to get that in your bones. And the culture complex that we go through examples tomorrow is really, if you get in your, get really inside what this is all about, you begin to, at one point, Tom and I did a thing on culture complexes for the Institute in San Francisco, and Tom Singer brought in that Daily Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, and he just started reading a couple of articles that had to do with what he thought was culture complexes, and I thought, what a great idea. I think what I'll do for the next year is I'll go through the newspaper, you know, Chronicle and the press and the Times and all that, and I'll just cut out the articles that had to do that I could use as examples of culture complexes. Well, after about 3 months, I said, "Hell with this." You know why? Because that's all there was. I had this fuzzy. What am I doing? Any day I can pick up the newspaper and get the same story, different players, same story.
Yeah,
sort of a complicated question. I was curious about your term of cultural libido. Starting to think that conservative Muslims, terrorists, and invisibility, and perhaps how that might relate to projection shadow.
Cultural, yes, I think.
Cultural libido. And then you tie that into invisibility and projection, and into invisibility, which might be related to projection shadow. If you're going with it.
Yeah, Tom, one of the cultural complexes that Tom Singer was able to tease out for himself and define was one he called the archetypal defenses of the collective spirit. And essentially what he showed with that was that the, I don't know how familiar you are with Kalshed's work, sort of archetypal defenses of the personal spirit, which is that when there's a wound or trauma or injury, the level of the trauma activates within the individual these forces that are designed to protect the self from further injury. You know, so these are, it could be like isolation or cutoffness or deadness or putting that live self on cold storage or something like that. And then at some point, that protective self turns against the self-protected. Okay, so what Tom said was that, well, you know, that happens at the level of the group also. Except that if you take the example of the Islam, the Palestinians and Israelis, essentially they both feel a threat at the collective level to their individual spirit. Okay, so to that, to the group spirit, and he had this wonderful little diagram of the, well, a picture of the Carinthians, the daimones, dancing around baby Zeus at the birth of Zeus, So these daimones were dancing around baby Zeus with swords, and the daimones were the forces that are activated, archetypal forces are activated to put. Protect the spirit of the group. Now, the point he makes, and this is all to answer your question, is that when the daimones are activated in one group to protect itself from the other group, the daimones in the other group is activated to protect itself from the same group. And strangely enough, he says that's what really the axis of evil is. The axis of evil is that you have two constellated groups activated to protect their group spirit acting toward each other. And so, yes, there's a projection of shadow, but more than that, there's a field that's activated that catches both parties up. They just start vibrating to each other, you know? And sort of like you can do this dance and they both are vibrating to each other. And there's no way out of that without some sort of consciousness at a psychological level, or if you don't have that, then to mutual obliteration. That's the other way out.
So prevent the possibility of dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be collective possession. Possession at the collective level. And that was, tomorrow I'll talk some more about the National Socialism and the German thing problem, because that's it's a very interesting way that Jung was able to identify what was happening before the rise of Nazism and Hitler from the reactions that he was experiencing in his patients to what was going on around in the collective. And he said, you know, what I'm seeing has little to do with personal complexes. These patients are reacting to something in the group. And he was able to utilize that as a way to get to a point of looking at what was going on in the culture and make some statements about that. Other questions?
Yeah. How did that conflict get, how did the dynamics change in the method that allowed them to use? What was the behavior of the creator in the solution to that problem that gave him different perspective?
Well, I have a kind of complicated response to that. One is that apartheid was dismantled, but I did spend a fair amount of time looking at the response to the dismantled apartheid situation and through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was set up as a way to process the trauma that happened in South Africa. So here's my complicated response to that. One is that I'm not quite sure, except that the world community responded and began to put sanctions on South Africa, and it became not politically, economically viable for the white community to stay in charge in the way they were in charge. And so there was a changeover at the political level, but the changeover at the interpersonal and the psychological level, at the collective level, I'm not sure about. I'm not sure how much that's changed. For one thing, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was set up to, was set up to be a forum that would allow the victims of apartheid, the perpetrators and the victims, to come in and tell their story. And the only requirement was that perpetrators and victims be 100% honest about it. And Desmond Tutu's idea for that was that that would be cathartic and healing for the culture and the collective. And they had over 20,000 people that come in and talk. Well, the reality is that the 80% or so of white South Africans who benefited from apartheid and the more than 90% of the black Africans who were victims of apartheid didn't participate. So it turns out that the those who were benefiting from it and those who were most wounded from it didn't participate in the process. And partially because those who benefited from it did not see it as a problem. They had insulated themselves from it at the collective level, the problem. So I actually make a reference to that in my paper on that invisibility item, because what I thought it was a valiant, beautiful attempt on Desmond Tutu's part in South Africa to create that. It just placed too much faith in the goodness of people to come forward and really own shadow at the level of the collective, just too much. Yeah, it was just too much. And that was one part. The other part is that it used the individual model of catharsis as a vehicle for healing. And I'm not quite sure that's what happened at the level of the group. You know, you can't. It's not enough tears, individual. There's the lines from Milos, Szeszlós Milos, you know, Szeszlós Milos, he's my current favorite poet. And so this is just a short little line here. Soil of annihilation, soil of annihilation, soil of hate. No word will purify it ever. No such poet will be born. Soil of annihilation, soil of hate. No word will purify it ever. No such poet will be born. No such poet will be born. Okay, so there's not enough individual tears to deal with that issue. It's a collective issue. And I, you know, my heart is with the effort, but it's a group level complex. You're talking Harry Stack? Or?
No, South Africa, the Solomon principles for how to.
Oh, I don't. I don't know those.
Oh, so that would be very interesting to look at how that field interacted, because it was a value Solomon preacher who saw the way the Christians were being conducted in South Africa.
Well, I certainly support the push to have a conscious set of attitudes that allow you to think about collective problems. And but the other side, that I think once you say complex, the other side of that, having these conscious principles, that have to allow the unconscious its voice. It has to have a place in the process. And that's the tricky one, because we try to subjugate the unconscious to our conscious attitude and our ideology, and it ends up turning over the ship all the time. So the conscious, the cultural complex ideas really is an attempt to keep the unconscious present in our understanding and looking at group phenomena and collective phenomena, because then we can keep asking the question, what is the psyche doing with this? What's the psyche doing? What's the psyche's response to it? How is it being structured? What's the psyche doing with the projection? What's the psyche doing with the shadow? What's the psyche doing with the kinship problem? What's the psyche, you know, we can keep asking that question, and it just keeps psyche right in front of us, and that becomes the big thing of, in terms of group development. Can we begin to identify what the psyche is doing and begin to struggle with those issues, because most of those issues are hardwired into the human thing, you know, that we have to, they require struggle and engagement. They just, yeah. We will be going through a number of these examples, cultural complexes, and I have some several cultural complexes that I did manage to pull out of the newspaper, and we will work with some of them, and as well as have you to generate some of your own. But the important thing, these examples